This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we're going to feature interviews with three actresses who are up for Academy Awards Sunday, all for playing women who, to one degree or another, are very intense. Later in the show, we'll listen back to interviews with Natalie Portman, who's up for Best Actress for Black Swan, and Jackie Weaver, who's up for Best Supporting Actress for Animal Kingdom. But first, let's listen to Terry's interview from earlier this year with another Best Supporting Actress nominee, Melissa Leo, for her work in the film The Fighter. Melissa Leo previously received an Oscar nomination for her starring role in the 2008 film Frozen River. On television, she's been featured in two excellent ensemble drama series, NBC's Homicide: Life on the Street in the 90s, and Tremé, now filming its second season for HBO. In The Fighter, a true story based on two brothers who are boxers, Melissa Leo plays their mother and manager. She's tough, crass, and small-time, but she has big ambitions for her sons. When the older son becomes a crack addict, she focuses on getting fights for her younger son, played by Mark Wahlberg. But sometimes they're the wrong fights, ones he can't win. Wahlberg's girlfriend, played by Amy Adams, thinks he shouldn't let his mother manage him anymore. In this scene, after Wahlberg takes a beating in the ring, Melissa Leo and her seven mean-looking daughters pay an unexpected visit to Wahlberg and his girlfriend.
Hi.
Well, 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 look at this.
Look at what?
Why are you hiding from us, Mickey?
He's not hiding.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to my son. What are you doing next to, huh?
I'm right here. I ain't hiding from nobody else.
What are you gonna do? Turn your back on Dickie next, huh? All we ever wanted for you was to be world champion.
Mickey's a grown man. He can think for himself.
Shut your mouth.
Skank. Don't call me skank. I'll rip that nasty hair right out of your head.
I'm his mother. And his manager.
You're not my manager anymore. And I'm not waiting for Dickie, okay? I'm not getting any younger.
Who's gonna look after you, sweetheart? I mean, come on. I know you don't understand it, but I had 9 kids. And I love every one of you the same.
You got a funny way of showing it, letting him get beat up, letting him get his hand broken.
You're crazy.
Boss! Mickey is my dad.
What did I just say to you?
I love that scene. Melissa Leo, welcome to Fresh Air. And congratulations on your nomination for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress and on winning the New York Film Critics Circle Best Supporting Actress Award. Good for you.
Oh, thank you so much. And now I get to be here talking to you. So,
Would you describe how you look in this film?
Well, I'm not very recognizable. I show up at lots of parties after the film has been screened. Nobody has any idea who I am in the room. She does not look like me. She looks like Alice Ward. She has a very stylish hairdo, very short, very white blonde, very teased and hairsprayed, and some fabulous costumes provided by Mark Bridges, who actually had the family albums, as did the whole production company, to make reference for Alice and the family during the years that our film takes place.
And you look so tough and hardened. Even the way you smoke your cigarettes, it's like you are puffing on them so hard. You are attacking those cigarettes. Everything in you is just like, it's so aggressive. Even like, there's something aggressive about your hair even. I mean, I can't explain it, but...
Yes, I see what you're saying. And I really think that, you know, having walked in Alice's shoes, she's actually a very gentle and loving lady. Do you know? But she saw an opportunity for her boys and rose above whatever she felt she might be inside of herself and made careers for the two of them. Now, the fight game is a ugly game, and I don't mean what happens in the ring. The management, the horror stories of fighters being duped by their own management, stolen from, put in life-threatening situations by their own people. It's just an extraordinarily nasty game, and I think if Alice has a little rough about her and a little aggressive about her, I think that it's something she's had to learn. Or how could she have gotten Dick in the ring with Sugar Ray? How could she have begun Mickey's career?
How did you get the part of the mother in The Fighter?
Well, ordinarily, I'll get a script first and sort of begin my decision making, off the page. For The Fighter, I had been told that David O. Russell wanted to see me. I found out later that Mark Wahlberg was very interested in me playing Alice Ward. And so David and I met, and I have to say, within about 5 minutes of meeting David, it was as if the part was mine already. He believed I was his Alice, believed in me so greatly that I found myself believing that with him and forgetting my very desperate and important question about, aren't I too young to play Mark and Christian's mother? And on we went, and off to the costume shop and the hair department and all the rest of it.
Too young? I hadn't thought of that. How old are they compared to you?
I don't know. There's not 10 years between us, I'll tell you that.
Wow. So what did you do to compensate for that?
I remember it being an enormous hesitation on my part to begin with. And I remember that at some point I saw that that question had sort of vanished. And just plowed on ahead, I guess, and believed myself to be their parent and the parent of the 7 other girls as well. And that's probably the biggest secret of acting. If the actor believes it themselves, I can make you believe it.
There's a scene in The Fighter after you've caught your son, who's played by Christian Bale. You've caught him at the crack house. You're trying to drag him back to your home. So you're driving him back. You're really angry with him and basically not talking with him. And then to try to win you over, he starts singing the Bee Gees song, I Started a Joke. And you eventually just kind of like warm up and you start singing along with him. Now, I have no idea whether that's a story that you or the screenwriter was actually told by a member of the family or whether that song was arbitrarily chosen. So I'm wondering if there's any backstory for that scene.
Yeah, it's a scene that's very dear and precious to me. We almost didn't shoot it. We shot it with very little light left in the day, and it's an exterior scene in the car there. You have to have God's light. God's light goes down at a certain time, whether we want it to or not. And it was really looking like it was getting squoze out, and the producers were kind of relieved because David really wanted that particular song, which might turn out to be rather expensive, and if they didn't shoot it, they wouldn't have to worry about it. And I said, you can't not shoot this. I've been sitting here for 5 hours waiting to shoot this, what I think is a very important scene. It's important because it says so much about the relationship between Dick and Alice, which is an important element in the story, where you're dealing with not only this exciting boxing triumph in the end, but you're also dealing with a very complicated family that both, as much as they might be detrimental to each other along the way, really can't live without one another. And I love that you spot that scene in the film. I love that it ends up being in the film. And I, not being a singer, loved having a duet with Christian Bale.
So how did David O. Russell choose that song? Why that one?
That is something you would have to ask Mr. O. Russell. All I knew was that it was ideal perfect. Like, why wonder? It was just so perfect. Why? How could you have thought of anything else? What a perfect song to sing right then, right there, and tell a story of many, many years of history, and many times the song might have been sung before in jollier moments. There's just so much there and such irony in the lyric of that song.
Yeah, and you know that means that they have their duets and they have their in-jokes, and he's just trying to kind of get back on that track with her.
And that she still sees, crack addict or not, she knows who that boy is, and she loves him. She's really mad that he lied to her.
No,
but she's not making judgment about him.
You have great scenes with Christian Bale and great scenes with Mark Wahlberg. Do they both approach acting differently and get into character differently?
Well, I think that it's fairly obvious that Christian goes in a very deep method type way into his character. I met him the day he was meeting Dick Eklund for the first time, and I actually watched this process of Christian morphing into this other man that he plays in the film. Mark comes with the 4 years of training and getting his body in the right shape and his boxing abilities in the right shape to be able to really sell the fighting in the movie the way that he does. But it doesn't come with a set of ideas of how the scene might play. Because I am this person, this is how I might do this, is the sort of question that Christian might ask himself going into it. Now, that's an assumption on my part. I don't know the inner workings of Christian. It's just, then Mark shows up and on a dime can offer you the same moment in the film with laughter, with fear, with hatred, with regret, with anything that David Russell asks in a single take, and Mark delivers. It's an extraordinary thing to watch. When you have an actor like Christian and you want to adjust the performance, you got to work a little harder because he's already done all this other work that you have to rework to get the, right? So it's two very, very different ways of acting that really suited the characters that they were playing and my relationship to them then.
2 years ago, you were nominated for an Oscar for your performance, your leading performance in the independent film Frozen River, in which you played a woman trying to raise a couple of kids on her salary from a part-time job at a dollar store. Your husband is a gambling man who's run off with the money that you'd save for a new double-wide trailer home. The home that you and your family do have is falling apart. So to get some income, you team up with a Native American woman who had stolen your car, and together you smuggle immigrants across the Canadian border to the U.S., and that requires driving over the frozen river that the movie is named after. Let me play a scene here. In this scene, you're confronting your son about damage he's done to the house while trying to repair frozen pipes with his father's blowtorch. You'd warned him against using that blowtorch, and he's damaged what's left of the home. So here's the scene.
What do you want? Something happened to Dad?
No.
What do you want?
Did you have a fire here last night?
The pipes froze, so I fixed them.
You fixed them?
Yeah.
Did you use the blowtorch?
Dad did it before.
So you used the blowtorch? Oh, look at this! We can't live here anymore.
So what? It's just a tin crapper.
No, this was our house.
So we're getting a new one, right?
That's it. No. Damn it.
What are you...
Son of a bitch! Don't touch it!
It's Melissa Leo in a scene from Frozen River. Well, I think it's great that you started really getting the accolades you deserve in, I guess, your late 40s, at a time when a lot of actresses are considered to have already reached their expiration date, which is so unfair.
Exactly right. Exactly, totally right. And it is with great pleasure that I share this recognition, that I shared the recognition about Frozen River with all of those women. I know many of them. I know many of them, and they are fine, fine actresses that maybe they weren't even ousted out of the business, but their hearts and bodies, souls couldn't take it anymore. The kind of like, oh, yeah, no, sort of, you won't. You know, it just is such a judgment placed. And you know, I it makes me then think of the relationships I had with both of my parents' mothers. And it was their age and their wisdom and what they had seen in life and what they had been through and things you couldn't do in a couple of years. You could only do in 60, 70, 80, 90 years. It's a very important part of living, getting older, anti-aging. Pah!
One of the things I really appreciate about your acting is that you're not vain about looking older. As far as I can tell, you haven't done Botox or plastic surgery, and I think a lot of actresses, once they turn 40 or even younger, are starting to get work done. So this is one of the reasons why I love watching you, because I feel like I'm watching a real face that shows signs of some age, like a real face. Are there pressures in the industry to get work done when you're an actress?
I have not encountered that. I was blessed with a mother who refused to raise a vain daughter. and it's really assisted me in my acting career. I don't really think so much about how pretty or how sexy the character is unless it's applicable to what she's got going on in her life.
Now, you're very good at playing tough women. Whether, you know, it's like the mother in Frozen River who is taking a lot of risks and being really tough in order to raise money for her family and for a home. Or, you know, in The Tough Mother in The Fighter. Or going back to Homicide, where a lot of people first became aware of you, where you played a detective, like the only...
She was a whole other kind of tough mother.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Did you ever play the ingenue? Were you ever in a teen comedy or anything like that?
No, I was not in a teen comedy. I don't know that I have a rom-com to my credit.
Which means romantic comedy for anybody who doesn't know the the contraction.
I was nominated for a Daytime Emmy in the ingenue category. In 1980-something or other.
Is this for All My Children?
For All My Children.
My guest is Melissa Leo, and she stars in the new film The Fighter, for which she was nominated for an Oscar. Now, you're in the series Tremé, and as we speak, you've been in the middle of shooting this series set in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, following characters dealing with going on with life after the floods, and you're shooting the second season, which will be shown in the spring. In the show, you play a civil liberties lawyer, and you're dealing with several people who have lost things or have been lost or missing because of the flood, and you're dealing with police issues and stuff. And your husband, who is played by John Goodman, is a professor who has gotten very caught up in the idea that the disaster part of the hurricane was really caused by man-made problems, by bad levees, by a bad response to the flood. And he's become absolutely obsessive about this and it's led him to become paranoid. And he's kind of not in a good place. At the end of the season, he kills himself. At what point did you know that that was going to happen?
I actually was lucky enough to know all along we would just have John for a year. The more I worked with him, the sadder that made me feel. He is a joy to work with. And I am grateful, too, that it wasn't shocking to me like most of Tony Burnett's life. I have episode 4 for season 2 right here in my bag with me. Anxiously, when I finish talking with you, I'm going to crack it open and read it and find out what's happening next with her and what's she thinking and what's she doing. Because by and large, we really, truly don't know. That particular thing I did know, and I have to say in retrospect, I'm very glad I did know, because it was devastating to me. And I spent the whole summer, like I think much of the country that watched Tremé, thinking, well, maybe he'll come back, though. But maybe he could come back. Maybe he wasn't really dead, and he'll be there. And I found myself sort of in that position, but there we are down there shooting again, and Mr. Goodman is not with us, I'm sorry to say. He lives down there and stops by the set from time to time, which is great.
So after you left Homicide, which is the first series that you did with David Simon, the creator of Tremé, what kind of work did you get afterwards?
Well, here's the ugly truth about that. I was fired from Homicide. I really needed the job. I had a small son and a fair amount of rather public strife going on at that time. I really needed the job, and they let me go, whether it was because I was having such a hard time personally or whatever. I shall never actually know. But it was a hard job to lose, and it was even harder once I got home, and I could not get hired to save my life. I had been working by then for more than 10 years, closer to 15, and I wasn't even getting auditions. And the scuttlebutt I began to hear, of course nobody ever says it to your face, had to do with, well, we don't want that. I had gone for the last 3 years of Homicide without any makeup on. It seemed to me a reasonable thing to do. I was working with male actors who weren't using any makeup. We were all playing police detectives. Why did I have to put makeup on? Aren't there women in the world, like myself, that don't wear makeup when they go out every day? Can we show that on national television? that might have had to do with why I was eventually fired from the job. But as I say, I'll never know. And very, very hard. There was something about the way Kay Howard landed with people, that there was a truth in her that made producers and so on feel that was me. And you know, they didn't want to see that again, or something like that. Eventually, it was really not until 21 Grams came around that there seemed to be an actual career afoot again.
Well, the fact that you had such a hard time after Homicide makes it all the more sweeter that you're getting such recognition now. Congratulations on all the recognition that you're getting now. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A joy to talk to you.
Melissa Leo, speaking with Terry Gross late last year. Melissa Leo is up for an Academy Award Sunday for her role as the mother of two boxing brothers in the film The Fighter. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today we're featuring actresses who are up for Academy Awards Sunday. Our next guest is Jackie Weaver, nominated for her role in the Australian crime drama Animal Kingdom, directed by David Michaud. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to both Jackie Weaver and David Michaud this year. Animal Kingdom follows a Melbourne family of bank robbers and drug dealers as the police close in on them. Weaver plays Janine Cody, the mom of the crime family. Animal Kingdom is the first feature film David Michaud has directed. In this scene, Weaver's character is concerned that a young member of the family may flip and testify against them, and she's leaning on a corrupt cop, played by Justin Rozniak, to have the boy killed in police custody.
Hey, Randall, before you go on, this boy who's currently being looked after, tell me if you agree with this, this boy who's being looked after, he knows who you are. And you know how these things go. They're going to ask him all sorts of questions about everything he's ever seen or done, everyone he's ever met, the whole schmozzle. And you've done some bad things, sweetie, haven't you?
Well, David Michaud, Jackie Weaver, welcome to Fresh Air. This character, Jackie's character, Janine Cody, or she's called Grandma Smurf at times, right, is such a sweetheart. And there's this amazing touch that we see early on, Jackie, where when you greet your sons and grandsons, all of them criminals, and there are many of them, you give them these nice, slow little kiss on the lips. Tell us about that gesture.
Gesture, though it's a small one, I think speaks volumes about the relationship she has with the boys. Because while it's not indecent or obscene, it is an inappropriate gesture to kiss your adult son lingeringly on the mouth. I have a son in real life who's in his 30s, and I can honestly, and I love him very much, and we're very close. I can honestly say I haven't kissed him on the mouth since he was 2.5 years old. But that was something I wish I could say that was my choice, my acting choice, but it was a little gesture of David's idea. And I think it just said so much in such a small gesture about the strange bond that exists in that criminal family, the power the mother has over them. She has had these sons with different fathers. They were obviously unsatisfactory, probably violent relationships with criminals, and there's also a kind of substitute with her sons, I think, perhaps. This is all surmise on my part. David, who wrote the film, might say I'm talking rubbish.
Yeah, David. So you've got the grandmother here planting these little kisses on her sons throughout the film. What inspired that?
I wanted just a kind of a small but powerful gesture that represented the almost proprietorial nature of the relationship that this woman has with her sons. You know, that in a way she appears very loving, but actually her relationship with her children is very self-serving. You know, that what she really loves, the idea of being at the center of a pack of quite young and powerful and dangerous men being her sons. And that's the level on which her love seems to operate. And so I kind of just liked that small and proprietorial gesture. I mean, it's funny, people talk about that, the kissing on the lips, quite a lot. And I actually know, I know mothers who kiss their sons on the lips. And so I've been quite surprised at how effective that gesture has been. I mean, there's another scene in the movie, I don't know if you remember it, but when Ben Mendelsohn's character first appears in the movie, Ben playing Jackie's eldest son, Jackie does that entire scene sitting on Ben's lap, which I actually think is a stranger gesture than the kissing on the lips. I don't know. I don't know mothers who sit on their son's lap.
You know, this is a film about kind of the daily life of criminals, David Michaud, and it's a pretty unglamorized view of their lives. Were there any kind of crime movie stereotypes you wanted to avoid?
I was very clear when I started that if I was going to make a crime film, that I was treading a well-trodden path, and that if I was going to bother doing this at all, there needed to be something about it that was unusual. So it was kind of clear to me that I needed to work out how Animal Kingdom might be different from other crime films. And not because there are a number of crime films that I love to pieces. And I had a clear sense from very early on, based on that first response I had to reading about the central event of Animal Kingdom, that kind of brutal revenge killing of those two young cops, that what I wanted to do was make a kind of sprawling Melbourne crime story that was very menacing, that had running through it, bubbling under the surface, a kind of a sense of fear and threat and impending violence. And then that kind of, in some ways, determined the tone of the film and the way the film should be made, you know, which is that it needed to be a crime film that took itself very seriously, you know, that that couldn't exist in a kind of a heightened a light universe. And in some ways that then determined also the nature of every decision that kind of stems from that, you know, in discussions that you have with actors and crew about playing things with truth.
Right. Well, you don't see criminals living extravagant lifestyles and spending a lot of money. You don't see them snapping off very funny lines, you know, like you would say in Goodfellas, for example. I mean, these are people who are living under an awful lot of stress.
Yeah. I mean, and they also, I mean, because in a way, what you're looking at, the film Animal Kingdom is a film about a particular crime family in decline. It's in some ways, you know, it's like the third act of Goodfellas in a way, as an entire film. You know, it's all of the crime in a way that you see in the film is defensive, backed into a corner, retaliatory crime. It's a film about a gang of armed robbers in which you don't see them committing armed robbery. What you see is them backed into a corner and committing the crime of paranoid retaliation.
Jackie Weaver, you know, you were in the Peter Weir film, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and American audiences will remember that. And you've basically for a long, long time been doing a lot of film, a lot of TV, and a lot of theater, especially in Australia. Was it ever your ambition to come to Hollywood and make a career here?
I know I've always had fantastic work offered to me at home. I've had a great career. I've done about 100 plays, and I've only done about 15 films. So I've been very lucky. I've played some leading roles in a lot of American plays in Australia that were very successful. So there hasn't really, I didn't really feel coming to America and not getting those leading roles was better than, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jackie, I have to ask you, is it true that you were fired from a Heinz 57 commercial set for laughing too hard in the shoot?
Well, I was playing an asparagus, Dave, and if you could see me, I'm a very tiny person. I'm under 5 feet tall. Yeah. If it was classic miscasting. I mean, if anything, I should have been the squash. and I just found the whole thing so wonderfully amusing in a Monty Python way that I got slightly hysterical, not in a loud way. I'm not a loud person, but I did find it impossible not to laugh all the time. And finally, the producer and the director were furious, and they said that they sent me home. They sacked me, and they rang my agent, said it was the most unprofessional behavior they'd ever seen in an asparagus.
Jackie Weaver and David Michaud, the co-star and director of Animal Kingdom, speaking to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies this year. She's up for Best Supporting Actress at Sunday's Oscars. Completing our visit with some of the actresses up for Academy Awards this weekend, we present Terry Gross's interview with Natalie Portman, who's nominated for Best Actress as the star of the dark and twisted ballet drama Black Swan.
I had the craziest dream last night about a girl who was turned into a swan. But her prince falls for the wrong girl, and she kills herself.
That's Natalie Portman in Black Swan, playing a ballerina in a New York City ballet company that's about to do its annual performance of Swan Lake. She gets the lead, playing the dual role of the innocent white swan and the seductive and evil black swan. In the process of preparing for the role, she goes deep into her dark side and confuses both herself and the film's audience about where reality ends and paranoid fantasy begins. The film was directed by Darren Aronofsky, who also directed The Wrestler. Natalie Portman made her film debut at the age of 12 in the 1994 film The Professional. Her other movies include Garden State and the three Star Wars prequels. Terry Gross spoke with Natalie Portman in 2010.
Natalie Portman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So what was the preparation like for you to try to develop a ballerina's body and movement?
I started training a year ahead of time with a great teacher, Mary Helen Bowers, who was in the New York City Ballet for 10 years. She started very basic with me, really focusing on strengthening my toes. We would do 15 minutes of just toe exercises a day to get ready for going on point, plus obviously ballet. And then we upped it to, we added more time as we went along, more hours a day of ballet, and we added swimming. We swam a mile a day. We toned. I watched the Frederick Wiseman documentaries on ABT and Paris Opera Ballet, which were really helpful, and read a lot of autobiographies of dancers. I tried to do mainly New York City ballet dancers because I thought it was important to locate it in a particular culture, to have a sort of specific world, because every company is very different. So it was sort of Balanchine era New York City ballet that gave me the background.
Are there things you have to do in ballet that you had to learn how to do that a human body would otherwise never do?
Absolutely. The turnout is extreme and, something that is not natural for a lot of bodies. I think because I had the dance training when I was little, it wasn't impossible for me to have turnout starting at 27.
Describe what turnout is.
Turnout is having your sort of from your hips to your toes pointing outwards instead of being parallel to each other. And, you know, everything is supposed to be turned out, every move, every tendu or grand battement, you need to be turned out. You have to sort of tuck your butt underneath and like pull in your stomach towards your back so that your back becomes flat and doesn't have an arch, which is not very natural for the spine. And of course, going on point is also very unusual. it's not a natural way for your body to hold itself.
So what happened to your feet in the process?
They get disgusting. The toenails fall off. They get blistered and calloused, and you don't want anyone to look at them and certainly not touch them.
What about the rest of your body? I read you dislocated a rib. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was the sort of worst injury I had, was a dislocated rib, which basically we just dealt with by not
Not breathing.
Yeah, exactly. No deep breaths for 6 weeks, and I didn't get lifted from my rib cage anymore. I got lifted under my armpits because that's sort of what does it. Yeah. But it wasn't the end of the world. You know, real dancers dance with such incredible injuries that you wouldn't even believe. You know, it's such a nightmare for them to be replaced. You know, once they've made it to the top and they get these great roles, they will dance on a sprained ankle or torn plantar fascia, twisted necks, you know, just to make sure that they can keep their moment.
There are some very gruesome, disturbing body images in the film. Maybe gruesome isn't exactly the right word, almost surreal. Like, mm-hmm. There's an image where your toes are completely stuck together. It's almost as if they'd grown into each other. And you're, like, trying to, like, pry them apart. And then there's an image of you peeling skin off your hand. You know, it's as if it's dry skin and you're peeling it off and, like, a whole bunch of skin comes off. And then you have this rash on your back, or never really sure what caused that, yes, or what it is. And it keeps getting bigger and uglier. You crack your feet and you crack your toes. And like, some of this reminded me of the kind of like body imagery you're likely to get in a surreal dream.
Right. Absolutely. Darren Aronofsky, our director, is clearly unbelievable. He is so good at physicalizing anxiety and terror and obsession. And that's so much of it for dancers. I mean, it's all about the way your body looks and the way your body moves. And when your worst anxiety and your worst terror is that you're going to be prevented from moving, or, you know, that your toes would stick together, or that you know, that your skin wouldn't be pale enough, or your body wouldn't be thin enough. I mean, these are real ideals that people talk about. And obviously any blemishes would be the worst nightmare to cover.
When you accepted the part in Black Swan and you were working with, you know, professional ballet choreographers and trainers, were people sizing you up and thinking, like, it's going to be tough? You know, she doesn't really have a ballet dancer's body, and we're going to have to stretch this and change that and move this. And was that a weird process, having people assess you and finding you, like, wanting and then figuring out how to fix you?
It was. And, you know, it's also, you have physical limitations. You know, I'm short and I have short limbs, and, you know, the Balanchine sort of city ballet ideal is to be very long. And they had me working with a physical therapist / gyrotonics teacher, Michelle Rodriguez, who's fantastic, who works with all the dancers in New York, to lengthen me. And she was literally just pulling my arms and opening my back and, you know, having me over a ball. I would be lying on this sort of small ball, and she would just open my shoulders and open my back and do arm exercises to try and slim my arms and lengthen them. I was given instructions to lose as much weight as I could without getting sick, and, you know, was told every day sort of by the coaches and stuff that I wasn't looking like a ballerina yet. And all of a sudden, when I really started dieting and lost a serious amount of weight, all of a sudden I started getting compliments from everyone. But it was very much like what that world is.
Now, Mila Kunis co-stars, and mm-hmm. she plays a new dancer in the company, and the ballet master thinks that she's very good, and in fact she becomes your understudy. And mm-hmm. It's always hard to tell whether she's trying to be your best friend or trying to totally undermine you so that she can take over as the lead. And this is where the thriller aspect of the
right.
of the movie comes in. Now, I read, and tell me if this is true, that the director of the film, Darren Aronofsky, actually created a backstage competition between the two of you, that he would tell you that she was doing better than you were in terms of really getting the ballet moves down, and then he'd tell her that you were doing better than she was.
Exactly.
So did he actually do that?
Yeah, it was really funny because Mila and I have been friends for years. And when we were, Darren and I have been talking about the film for 10 years. And finally, when it started rolling a year ahead of time, he said, you know, do you have any ideas for who could play Lily? And I was at the flea market with Mila and I was telling her that I was doing the ballet training. And she's like, oh, be careful. I broke all of my toes doing ballet. And so I called up Darren and I was like, Mila dances, Mila dances. So then, you know, he met her and cast her, which was really exciting to work with a friend. But then I was like, why can't we train together? You know, we're doing the same thing. Can't we take class? He kept us completely separate. He tried to make us like not see each other. And then he would tell me things like, Mila's looking really good. And then he would tell her like, oh, Natalie's so much better than you. And we would talk. So we knew that he was totally just messing with us. And we would just laugh because, you know, we'd go out for our salad or whatever we were eating at the time and, you know, dish on what kind of feedback he was giving each of us. So we didn't really let him manipulate us as he desired.
Natalie Portman speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. Natalie Portman, Jackie Weaver, and Melissa Leo will all learn whether they've won Oscars on Sunday night when ABC televises the 83rd Annual Academy Awards. The Rhode Island brothers, Bobby and Peter Farrelly, made their names with outrageous R-rated comedies, such as Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary. After a few less successful PG-13 pictures, they're back to their filthy ways for their 10th film, Hall Pass. Owen Wilson stars, along with Jason Sudeikis from Saturday Night Live, Jenna Fischer from The Office, and Christina Applegate. David Edelstein has a review.
The Farrelly brothers are sometimes thought of as the dumb adolescence version of the Coen brothers, which is on one level true, and on another, slanderous. Because even with their characters' unruly bodily functions and hormones, the Farrelly's movies have a spirit that's remarkably gentle and humanistic. Their comedy, Hall Pass, is a mixed bag. Often it's desperate. Often it's droopy. But they've made one of the few recent movies about the perpetual immaturity of the American male with a mature perspective. I did groan when I heard the premise of Hall Pass, which made me think the Farrellys were regressing. But it's actually the male characters that are regressing, or rather, that long to regress. They're married buddies on the verge of 40. Rick, played by Owen Wilson, and Fred, played by Jason Sudeikis from Saturday Night Live, are sexually frustrated. Their wives are rarely, for one reason or another, available to them, and their own bodies are beginning to lose their elasticity. They live in a fantasy world, prone to checking out young women who pass, while laughably denying or trying to hide their interest. But their spouses, Maggie and Grace, played by Jenna Fischer and Christina Applegate, miss nothing. A psychologist friend of theirs, played by Joy Behar, tells them to give the boys a week off from marriage. She calls this a hall pass. The hall pass idea is, frankly, creepy. It suggests that middle-aged men sentenced to monogamy can go back to high school, which, of course, they can't, even if they have, quote, permission. When Maggie and Grace head off on vacation to Cape Cod, Rick and Fred hit the local Applebee's with three of their pals, played by Stephen Merchant, Larry Joe Campbell, and J.B. Smoove, who are along to experience their conquests vicariously.
This place is dead.
Okay, well, the guy at the Comfy Night Inn said it doesn't really kick in until about 9:30, so...
Why you guys staying at a hotel if your wife's out of town?
Oh, come on, Flats. I can't very well bring a bunch of models back to my place. What if they end up stalking me? And Rick's house has got a bunch of family photos and kids' drawings on the fridge. Yeah.
Are you guys sure Applebee's is the best place to meet hot, horny women at?
What do you think, an Olive Garden?
Providence, Rhode Island, where Hall Pass is set, has quite a few excellent watering holes for singles, which makes going to Applebee's especially far-fetched. But the gag does resonate. These guys want to stay in their safety zone. One actor not in his safety zone is Owen Wilson, for years dubbed in racy tabloids the Butterscotch Stallion and a symbol of stoner cool. Here he's a fellow with thinning hair and slack muscles and the start of a paunch. His trademark, spacey demeanor is now tinged with regret. It's a terrific performance, and terrifying, because if Owen Wilson can age, well, what chance do I have? Jason Sudeikis' character is more extreme, more infantile, but I love how he goes for broke. And when Hall Pass needs another shot of energy, Richard Jenkins arrives and brings down the house as a self-professed love doctor named Coakley, a worldly hipster who analyzes the availability of women in clubs with the keen eye of Sherlock Holmes. But for all the raunch and nudity and juvenile gross-out gags that go along with the men's desperate exploits, it's the women who become the film's emotional center. There they are on Cape Cod, and they're suddenly being hit on by guys, middle-aged and even in college, and they like the attention. They like being pursued again. They realize that they wanted a hall pass, too. But along with that comes a grimmer realization that once more they're objects in the psyches of unreliable males. There's an idea in Hall Pass that the Farrellys don't point up, but I think it's in the movie in spades, that people often depend on what Eugene O'Neill called the life lie, a false vision of themselves to keep despair at bay. In the Farrellys' culture, men in committed relationships need to believe it's only their spouses who prevent them from scoring all the time. And without that fantasy, something inside them would die. Hall Pass leaves you with that sad and wise view of adulthood, even if you'd never dream of putting the words the Farrellys and Eugene O'Neill in the same sentence.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.